Listen, everyone makes messes. It's just a part of life. And the bigger you live, the bigger the mess, if you know what I mean. That's why you need Fabuloso. With twice the active cleaning ingredients, it just completely takes the drama out of any mess. It smells great while you clean. The only way to describe it is the scent of passion. And once you're done cleaning, it lasts so long. You know, if you make a mess, you can get your home dramatically clean with Fabuloso. No worries.
Hello, and welcome to the Latin American History Podcast. Episode 110, Juan de Oñate and the Foundation of New Mexico. Before beginning today, I wanted to quickly mention a couple of things. The first two are interesting news stories about Latin American historical discoveries. A long time ago, before telling the stories of his journeys, we did an episode called Who Was Christopher Columbus? We talked about the various theories, as well as the fact that the most commonly accepted idea about his origins was that he was from Genoa in Italy. Well, analysis of DNA taken from his remains has suggested that this might not actually be the case. According to a professor at the University of Granada who did the study, the DNA results suggest that not only was he probably from Spain, not Italy, but that he may have also had a Jewish family history. The findings are outlined in a documentary which is on YouTube, although it is in Spanish, if you want to learn more. I haven't watched it myself, but if the study is correct, it certainly is a surprise, given the weight of documentary evidence which led most to believe that he was from Italy. The second story is about the discovery of a previously unknown Maya city in the jungles of Campeche State in Mexico. This was discovered partly by chance by a PhD scholar named Luke Auld Thomas, looking at LIDAR imagery and happening to notice some lumps on the ground. It was also partly discovered thanks to the advances of technology, namely the LIDAR scanning, which is upending our knowledge of civilizations across the world, as it strips away jungles and allows us to read the terrain with much greater ease than ever before. There are a couple of interesting aspects to this. Firstly, it's intriguing that this place, which has been named Valeriana after a nearby lagoon, was previously unknown. It is apparently close to a main road, so archaeologists would have driven past it many times, unaware that it was there. It may be given a new name one day, if we can identify what the Maya called it. And this leads on to the second interesting point. It seems surprising that the second largest known city was not mentioned in the glyphs of other cities, that we have found no reference to it before now. Perhaps excavation at the site itself might uncover that name. In one of the articles I read about the discovery, that PhD student expressed his thought that it may not even be excavated. I guess this is the paradox of our time when it comes to archaeology. We are able to make amazing discoveries like this through new technology, but finding funding for actual excavation can be difficult. It feels crazy that the second largest Maya city can be discovered, yet it might just sit there unexplored. A final point about this is that it shows how this remote and sparsely inhabited part of Mesoamerica was so important to the Maya world. While places like Chichen Itza and Tikal are more famous, not that far away in relative terms, and also in Campeche State, is Calakmul, the largest known Maya city, while El Mirador, the one with the tallest pyramid, is just over the border in Guatemala. The last thing I wanted to mention before getting started today is that last month's Friends of the Podcast episode has been released. It looks at two fascinating Argentine folk saints, one the personification of death and derived from an indigenous god, the other a legendary cowboy who stole from the rich and gave to the poor. Both are believed to perform miracles for those who provide them with something in return, and they are popular amongst the poor, prisoners, and the socially excluded. The episode looks at the history of these figures and the sociology behind their popularity. If you're interested in hearing about them and getting access to future and previous Friends episodes, you can join up for $2 a month. Recent episodes have looked at the life of Bartolomé de las Casas and the mysterious Bolivian civilization of Tiwanaku. There's a link with information in the episode description. Today we are starting a mini-series of episodes about the life of Juan de Oñate and the establishment of New Mexico. We've covered a few stories of exploration in what is now the USA. Narvaez's Odyssey from Florida and around the Gulf to Mexico is one example. And recently we looked at De Coronado's attempts to find the mythical cities of gold he believed were up there. None of these attempts to settle the USA have stuck, however. By the time period we are covering here, settlements had been established in what is now the southeast of the USA by the Spanish, which we will probably deal with one day. But the Spanish hadn't really expanded much further north than their bases in the Caribbean and central Mexico. Oñate's story, then, encompasses the first real expansion up there and will result in the establishment of the oldest state capital in the USA, New Mexico's Santa Fe. It is his first expedition for which he is most famous, the one in which he established a new Spanish territory. From this base, though, he did actually embark on two more further ones into North America. We will deal with all of them here and tell the story of his later life. Oñate and his family were intimately tied with the settlement of northern Mexico. He set off on his first expedition in 1598, so we're talking about 70 or 80 years after Cortés had conquered Mexico City. That's not that much time within the grander scheme of the Spanish Empire, but it is, of course, a good lifetime, and a lot can happen in a lifetime. When we told the story of that conquest, we talked a little bit about some pushes to the north of Tenochtitlan, Mexico City. But for the most part, the northern third of Mexico was sparsely settled and not a priority. We saw that this was again the case when we looked at De Coronado's expedition. He pretty quickly found himself beyond Spanish settlement when he set off from central Mexico. Now this was still largely the case. The far north is marked by deserts and land which would have been unattractive to Spanish settlers. In the time frame we are looking at today, it was still largely empty. But in those years between Coronado and Oñate, there had been some pushes north. The reason for this was that those precious metals the Spanish always craved had been discovered. Places like Guanajuato and Zacatecas would become some of the richest sources of silver in the whole empire, and so rushes had started when this silver was first discovered. Oñate's father had founded Zacatecas, and so, although already very rich, he had got a lot richer. This was just one of the things he was notable for. Juan's father was among the most powerful people in Mexico. He was a Basque and had come over very early after the conquest. When the governorship of New Galicia was established, a subordinate unit under the control of Mexico City, created to bring the disparate northern settlements to better administration, he served as its governor three times. When Cortés went down to Honduras to try and bring Central America under the control of his viceroyalty, Oñate's father was part of the council of people put in charge of ruling the viceroyalty in his absence. Oñate's father died when he was a child, so he didn't have the benefit of his guidance. But of course, he had access to his wealth, power, and connections. His mother was also from a well-established family, from the south of Spain, who had been married once before to a man from one of the most important families down there. I have read that she abandoned her first husband, but not much is known about her in truth. Interestingly, she had a couple of branches in her family tree of converso Jews, but this doesn't appear to have hindered her too much. Given all of this, it would have seemed natural and expected that Oñate would play an important role in the society and administration of northern Mexico. He doesn't seem to have done too much, however, until he was around 50, at least in comparison to his father, and what he did after he reached his half-century. He didn't partake in the government of the colony and possess fancy titles, except for a stint running the mines at newly established San Luis Potosí, named after the great Potosí mine in Bolivia. He does tell us that he spent much of his adulthood fighting to expand the Spanish frontiers against the Chichimec peoples. There is little detail, however. We can't point to a large swathe of territory and say that Oñate was the one who conquered it, although we do know of a few silver mines which he probably discovered and established. During this time, before embarking on the expeditions for which he is known to history, he married Isabel de Tolosa Cortés de Moctezuma and had two children with her. At the end of the series on the conquest of Mexico, I mentioned how the two rivals of that conquest, Cortés and Moctezuma, became entwined and produced a line of descendants who had both as ancestors. Isabel, as you can probably tell by the name, was one of them. Cortés was her grandfather, and Moctezuma was her great-grandfather. This is further proof of Oñate's prominent position in Mexico. Isabel died, however, in the early 1590s, and so it was perhaps this which spurred Oñate to undertake his most famous exploits so late in life. There had long been a plan to conquer the vast north beyond the mining settlements, which Oñate and his father had participated in establishing. Not much had actually been done since De Coronado, however. It's worth remembering that we draw a sharp line between Mexico and the Spanish world, and the USA today, but this wasn't always the case. Back then the British had not even started their first colonies, and Spain claimed everything up there through the Treaty of Tordesillas. When I say conquer the north then, we are talking about a nebulous and largely unknown mass of land. Oñate was made governor of this area, on the condition that he conquer it first. Now it's worth talking about names briefly here. What is now Mexico was called New Spain by the Spanish. Spain itself was an agglomeration of kingdoms, and they seem to have liked to name new territories in this area after these original states. While there was a New Granada in the northern part of South America, they seem to have saved the old kingdom names for New Spain. New Galicia, where Oñate was based, was named after Old Galicia, the northwest corner of Spain, and there was also a new Vizcaya, new Basque country. This latest territory was to be known as New León and Castilla. Both León and Castilla were old kingdoms which now formed the heart of Spain. In common parlance, however, New Spain was already being referred to as Mexico, after the Mexica, part of the Aztec Triple Alliance, and Tenochtitlan was starting to be called Mexico City. Just as New Spain was seen by some as a land of potential and opportunity for those who had not found it in Old Spain, some had high hopes for this new unsettled land to the north, away from the rapidly solidifying administration in Mexico City, where much of the land had already been handed out. New León and Castilla quickly began to be known as New Mexico, even though this wasn't its official name. There had been attempts to conquer it, but only a couple, and these were not authorized by the Spanish crown and the viceroyalty. One of these is the subject of this month's upcoming Friends of the Podcast episode, which will be released in a few weeks. I will give details close to the time, but we don't need to know about that to tell Oñate's story. Another was very recent, at the time when Oñate was given his title, and part of his contract for the conquest required him to track down a man named Leyva, who had disappeared into the north after defying orders not to, and to bring him back for questioning. We will come back to this later in this mini-series when the time comes. Oñate left in 1598, but was initially commissioned in 1595. It took 3 frustrating years before he could get going. The main reason for this was a change in leadership in New Spain. The viceroy, who had initially drew up the contract, and who was a friend of his, was reassigned to the more prestigious position of viceroy in Peru. His replacement was less enthusiastic about the plan. He wanted to check the contract, and in the end he made several changes to it. Foremost amongst these changes was the closing of potential grey areas in the wording, which he judged might allow Oñate to establish a new viceroyalty, independent of New Spain and answering directly to the crown. He wanted the land which was conquered to be a governorship underneath his control. Oñate hadn't expected this delay, and so he had begun recruiting soldiers immediately. Chief among these were several Basque relatives by marriage who would form the leadership of the expedition. Even once the contract had been sorted out, with much less generous terms for Oñate, who had no real power to dispute this, they would have to wait while the new viceroy and the king debated whether the expedition should go ahead. At one point another candidate was chosen, and it looked like the whole thing might fall apart before it even begun. In the end, however, he was finally given the go-ahead. There was a late hitch when an inspector was sent to make sure that Oñate had gathered the amounts of supplies and soldiers required by this contract, just before he set off. When another of these inspections had been done a couple of years before, he had 5 men over the minimum required amount. But with all the delays, some had been forced to drop out and find more immediate sources of income. Now he was 71 short. But this was resolved by simply paying the viceroyalty money instead. The expedition finally began their march to the most northern outpost of the empire, a place named Santa Barbara. Santa Barbara was in the south of what is today the Mexican state of Chihuahua. A modest mine had been established there, as well as a mission for converting the indigenous peoples of the region. It was tiny and barely connected to the rest of the empire. Perhaps mining camp would be a better description of it than town, but it would have to do. It would serve as a useful staging post for Oñate, and after his conquests, it would help to make trade and movement between Mexico and New Mexico possible. One of the priests there saw an opportunity for further missionary work and joined the expedition with his team of missionaries, so that he could be the first to start converting the people they found in this new land. It's worth mentioning here as well that this was to be a scheme of colonization as well as exploration. It was not just soldiers and priests who marched with Oñate through the desert. This was a huge expedition, with servants, herds of animals, and cartloads of supplies, which would slow their progress, but hopefully ensure that they had everything required to found a self-sustaining colony immediately. There were slaves from Africa and Mesoamerica, and many of the soldiers brought their families as well. We don't know too much about what these later groups of people thought, as their opinions are not recorded. Amongst the family, you could guess that there would have been a range of opinions. Some of the wives may have been ambitious and been up for the hardships the journey would impose upon them as they sought social and financial improvement for their families. Others may have been frustrated to be dragged along and unable to convince their husbands to stick with the safety of what they knew. By this point, the process of mestizaje was well underway in Mexico. That is, the unions of Spanish and indigenous people, resulting in children with ancestry from both continents. We have seen this already in Oñate's wife, although her family members could claim much more illustrious ancestry than the majority. Many of these wives would have been mestizas as well, among the first Mexicans to migrate to what is now the USA, although of course neither of these countries or the border between them existed at the time. There isn't too much in the easily accessible historical record about this, but there are plenty of family history pages whose authors suggest that a lot of New Mexicans today can trace distant ancestry to these families. Onyate excitedly pushed north. Of course, he would have had no idea of the significance that this river would later have, marking the border between Mexico and the USA. But on Ascension Day, he reached the Rio Grande and claimed everything north of it for Spain. A few days later, he crossed it at the place where Ciudad Juárez and El Paso are today. Those first days were marked by some difficulty. Their supplies were running low. They were also making the same mistake as Coronado and travelling through the area in winter, so it was very cold. Soon, though, they reached the Tigüex pueblos that Coronado had reached on his trip, and this pleased Oñate. The Chichimec peoples he had known his whole adult life in north-central Mexico were nomadic, and their society was not one of great cities and riches. These settled communities were interpreted as a sign of greater development, as the Spanish saw it, and they believed it suggested that there might be another great and rich empire somewhere up there to be conquered. The people of these communities were not hostile. They helped the Spanish by providing food and clothing. Presumably, they understood the significance of the rituals which Oñate conducted, when they peacefully agreed that the King of Spain would be their new ultimate authority. Soon, though, the demands and liberties were starting to weigh on the indigenous peoples. Oñate complained that they would often run away at the sight of approaching Spaniards, rather than act like good subjects. This was, of course, the same area which Coronado had reached, and although the generation alive at the time was probably gone, the memory of that conquistador would have informed their distrust of this one. There was a drought when summer came, and this further fostered resentment. We have seen this story before. There was barely enough food for the indigenous people to support themselves, let alone fulfill the demands of outsiders. But those demands kept coming whenever indigenous people could be located, and this caused more resentment. Still, though, things did not spill over into outright hostility at this point. When Oñate reached a place he records as being called Yunque, he found it occupied, and the people there welcomed him in. He was shown to a place called Oque or Wingue, and he liked it enough that he decided to make it his base, renaming it San Juan de los Caballeros. This would be his new capital, although presumably he hoped to expand into yet undiscovered, richer territory, and create a new capital when he did so. The town was known as San Juan until 2005, when it was decided to revert back to its indigenous name. Oñate decided to pause here and regroup. It was the first time they had stopped marching since leaving Santa Barbara. Oñate sent pairs of priests to each of the pueblos in the region, so that they could begin the process of conversion. He also began handing out parcels of land to his most prominent followers. In his initial contract, he had asked for, and it looks like he was going to be given, the right to create encomiendas. And this would of course meant that those parcels of land would have had indigenous peoples assigned to work it. This is interesting, as by this point the encomienda system was supposed to have been abolished, although we know that it persisted in practice in many places. I'm not sure whether encomiendas were created, or if it was just the land which was given to his followers. Oñate wanted to establish himself in his new base, and give his men a bit of comfort. This was important because there was growing dissatisfaction among some of them. The lack of supplies had made the march difficult, but there was also some impatience. While Oñate was pleased to find settled communities with defensive structures in the form of the pueblos, as opposed to the more nomadic Chichimec, this wasn't enough for some of his followers. They wanted riches, and so far they had found none. This was not a great empire like the Aztec, and they were yet to find any evidence of untapped silver deposits like those in old Mexico, which could make them their fortunes. A few soldiers decided to desert, and Oñate had no tolerance for this. Three of them were caught in the act, and it took the intervention of the priests to stop him ordering their execution. They managed to convince him that it would only make the rest of the men more unhappy. Another four were not so lucky. Two Spanish brothers and two Portuguese men made it 20 miles from San Juan before being caught. The brothers escaped, but the Portuguese men were killed. Another reason for stopping was that so that Oñate could send men out in different directions and judge which direction to move in next. The first group went north and found one small deposit of metal, which encouraged the Spanish, even if it was the only one, and not a very big one at that. Another group went west and encountered more pueblos. A final group went east, and it was their journey which was the most notable. They reached the Great Plains, coming back with reports of enormous wild flocks of cattle. They had found the buffalo herds. They tried to catch some but failed completely. Three of their horses were killed in these attempts by stampeding buffalo. They also met a man named Giuseppe, who told them that he was from Old Mexico and that he had come to be there, having been taken as a guide by the illegal Leyva expedition, which Oñate was supposed to track down. This would have to wait for now, but it was useful information, and we will meet Giuseppe again soon. Other events would take place before Oñate could follow this lead, and we will look at them in part two. If you've enjoyed this episode and you feel like helping out, one thing you could do is leave a review wherever you get your episodes from. This really helps new people discover the show. Thank you to everyone who's already done this, and thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast, written and produced by me, Max Argent, edited by Alex McNamara. If you want to become a friend of the podcast and gain access to a bonus episode each month, as well as helping to support the running of the show, there's a link with information about how to do this in the episode description. The podcast can also be found on Facebook and Twitter by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. Here, I post updates about new episodes, as well as interesting articles I find about Latin American history. Thank you for listening.
When it comes to cleaning your house, who doesn't wish un galán with a trust fund swept in and pass the mop to your evil stepmom like in the telenovelas? Hola, it's Chiquis here, and although life isn't always like in the soap operas, Fabuloso does bring a clean that's always over the top. Get your home dramatically clean anytime you like without any evil mama drama. Just long-lasting lavender freshness. That's Fabuloso, taking the drama out of any mess.
Fabuloso's 2x concentrated formula provides 2x more active ingredients versus non-concentrated Fabuloso original. Use as directed.